This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Whitey Von Nita played one season in the NBA.
My real name's Stanley, but no one ever called me that, I think, while I was playing.
He's the oldest man alive to have played in the league.
Well, I'm 97.
In 1947, Whitey was approached by Leo Ferris, owner of the National Basketball League's Tri-City Blackhawks. Ferris offered Whitey a $2,000 signing bonus to move from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to Moline, Illinois, to play ball.
We hammered out a deal, and I finally went and played for him.
At the time, the National Basketball League, or NBL, was facing competition from the BAA, Basketball Association of America, the upstarts, Whitey calls them. Each league was trying to put the other out of business, but Whitey says the players weren't worried.
No, we were happy for it because we figured they'd be trying to get ball players and the price of our contract would go up.
In August of 1949, the two leagues merged, and in October, newspapers announced the upcoming schedule.
NBA opens October 29th. The Tri-Cities Blackhawks will meet the Denver Nuggets in the first game in the history of the new National Basketball Association.
The NBA, a merger between the BAA and NBL,
will have 17 teams to be split into three divisions.
Whitey played for the Blackhawks, so I figured he'd still remember what he was doing 70 years ago this week on October 29th, 1949.
That was the first game in the NBA. I didn't play in that game.
Uh-huh.
But I played in 1949, in the first year of the league, you know.
So were you there for that first game, just not on the court?
Well, I wasn't. Our team didn't play in that game at all.
Oh, okay. Whitey was so sure, I figured I must have been wrong. But I looked it up. Whitey's team definitely played in that game. And so did he. In the paper the next day, Whitey Von Nita was listed as the second highest scorer for the Blackhawks, with 14 points. Maybe Whitey just forgot. He is more than twice my age, and I can't remember what I was doing last Tuesday. Or maybe there's something else going on. Because for the past six decades, the NBA has been celebrating a different birthday in a move some sports historians have suggested might be an intentional erasure of one of its two founding leagues. The NBA has instead celebrated this game, played 3 years earlier on November 1st, 1946.
Basketball makes its debut in Toronto as the New York Knickerbockers and the Toronto Huskies white jerseys tangle.
Help me out. When was the first NBA game actually played?
The first NBA game in history was played on October 29th, 1949, Karen.
Sean Kirst is a columnist for the Buffalo News, and back in August, he wrote about this discrepancy over the league's founding date. Was it 1946 or 1949? So if the first NBA game was 70 years ago this week, why did the NBA tell you that they're getting ready to celebrate their 75th birthday?
So can I back up and just kind
Please
of give
do.
You the... Okay. So the deal is years ago, many years ago in Syracuse, a woman calls me and says that her husband deserves a lot more credit in basketball history, particularly with the 24-second clock, and it was Beverly Ferris.
And if this is sounding a little familiar, it's because Sean helped tell the story of Beverly, her husband Leo, and the 24-second clock on our show a couple years ago.
And I go to her house and she pulls out a grocery bag full of clippings and you know, those old scrapbooks. And so I'm fishing through this grocery bag and I pull out a yellowed clipping that shows Leo, Ike Duffy of the Anderson Packers, Ned Irish of the New York Knicks, and Walter Brown with Maurice Poteloff, the first president of the NBA, and they're surrounding a basketball on August 3rd, 1949, and this article says this is the birth of the NBA, and I'm stunned.
Now, just to be clear, Sean wasn't stunned because of that date, August 3rd, 1949. He was stunned because Leo Ferris, husband of Beverly, who by that time was unable to speak and dying of Huntington's disease, was at the center of the photo.
I mean, Leo's there. He's in the middle and helping to put together this new league. And it turns out that he played kind of the Al Davis role. He was the guy who went out and signed players out from underneath the BAA. And then, you know, I start writing about that.
A couple years ago, Sean started writing for the Buffalo News, and he figured the 70th anniversary of the day that photo was taken would be a good time to introduce his new readers to Leo Ferris, who founded the Buffalo Bisons, the team that later became the Tri-Cities Blackhawks, and eventually the Atlanta Hawks.
And so I contact the NBA and I say, what are you doing for your 70th anniversary? I'm totally naive. And I'm initially met by silence. And then I get an email back that says, well, our 75th anniversary is in 2021. So I do some math and it doesn't compute, you know. It's like, no, it's not. And it's utterly nonsensical. It makes no sense. And so that leads into all of this.
All right. So according to the NBA, the first game was on November 1st, 1946. What did actually happen that day?
Well, that was the beginning of the Basketball Association of America.
The New Yorkers show some nice ball handling, and after a few preliminaries, they score a clean first basket.
Unlike the game Whitey Von Nita played in, this first game, this first basket, has been celebrated. They even made a documentary about it.
Ossie Schaekman received the pass from Leo Gottlieb. And Leo Gottlieb said if he had known that this was that important, he wouldn't have made the pass, but he would have made the shot for himself.
But if we're going to be completely accurate, Ossie Schaekman didn't make the first basket in the NBA. He made the first basket in the BAA.
The BAA, it's a bunch of rich guys in big cities who start a league in 1946, but there's already a professional league called the National Basketball League. So the BAA sets out to sort of become basketball's major league, but they've got this problem of this other league that's got better players.
So the NBL, the older small city league, had better players. The BAA, the upstart big city league, had bigger venues and richer owners.
These two leagues go to war, and you know, the BAA's got more money. But it's a war of attrition, and no one's doing that well.
In 1947, the BAA used that extra cash to lure four teams away from the NBL.
So two of the teams that jump are Minneapolis and Rochester, who will become the dominant teams in basketball's early history. So at that point, the NBL appears to be staggered, but Leo Ferris, who has founded this team in Buffalo and then moved it to Moline, goes out basically to wreak vengeance and to try and force a merger. And so in 1948, he signs Dolph Schayes, which is a sort of a titanic signing, and he signs him out from underneath the Knicks. And Dolph is a huge star. And then a year later, Leo goes out and just signs the starting five from Kentucky and gives him a team in Indianapolis.
When Sean says Leo gives Kentucky's starting five a team, he means that literally. The players got ownership, and that was a huge threat to those rich owners in the BAA.
And so the BAA is a little shaken by this, and Maurice Podoloff finally says, okay, we're going to sit down and put an end to this. So they finally come to the table, and in 1949, they merge, and they create the National Basketball Association. And I defy you to go, if you go into old clips, to find a clipping from that period that does not say that it was a merger that created a new basketball league.
I think it's the Syracuse newspaper has a headline that says, NBL and BAA merged to create National Basketball Association.
That's Curtis Harris. He's a doctoral student in history at American University, and he runs the website and Twitter account Pro Hoops History.
Newspaper articles, journalists, basketball folks at that period are saying, this is a brand new league. It's starting at this moment with the combination of two previous leagues.
And Curtis says that's how everyone talked about the NBA, as a brand new league, all during that first season and on through the 1950s. But in the 1960s, the narrative changed.
I would say, unfortunately, as time has gone on, the people associated with the NBL, that half of the NBA's parentage, they slowly lost, their power to help keep alive and tell these stories. And the folks from the BAA side of things, they got greater and greater power over the narrative and have been able to just, in essence, rewrite the origins of the NBA.
Former NBL teams won the first six NBA championships. But while those small city NBL teams were dominating on the court, Sean Kirst says big city BAA owners were dominating in the boardroom.
The BAA had a little bit more in the way of financial resources. They had an office in the Empire State Building. So you know, Podoloff remains as president. And it's interesting, Podoloff had some, you know, the quote, like, we'll bury you or something like that. And they did it historically. The real crime of this, the real shame of it, is that it's a 70-year-old grudge that's still being played out.
So what's the big deal? Why does it matter whether the league was founded in 1949 or 1946, whether it was a merger or, as the NBA now claims, merely a name change?
Gosh, where do you start? It's
again, Curtis Harris.
Well, for starters, you know, if they wanted to incorporate both of those two leagues into their history, the NBL was founded officially in 1937. So if the NBA recognized the NBL, it'd add about, you know, 12 years to its history.
As Curtis and Sean both argue, by ignoring those 12 years, by rewriting history, the NBA is allowing people who were important to the early days of the game to be forgotten. People like Leo Ferris and Pop Gates, the African-American player Leo signed to play for the Tri-Cities Blackhawks in 1946, 6 months before Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball. Or the six black players for the Chicago Studebakers, one of two majority black teams that started the NBL season in 1942.
And that's absolutely something that would not occur in the NBA until the mid and late 1960s, where you had a majority black team. If the NBA incorporated the NBL, you'd get this great racial history, these great histories of these smaller towns that incubated basketball and made possible what happened in the NBA. Just many great players that have kind of gotten forgotten and don't even get into the Basketball Hall of Fame anymore because the NBA doesn't recognize the NBL.
When Sean Kirst sat down to write that column about Leo Ferris, the Buffalo Bisons, and the NBA's 70th birthday, he thought maybe he could get the attention of the Basketball Hall of Fame to remind them again about Leo. But
I called him and said, when was the NBA born? And they just didn't comment. Karen, I'm not kidding you. I couldn't get a comment out of the Hall of Fame about this. So if the Hall of Fame is not acknowledging that the NBA was created on August 3rd, 1949, then what does that mean for the people who took part in that creation? Well, it means that they didn't do it, right? And that's just bizarre and it's a loss to me.
Well, that sort of brings me to something that I wanted to talk to you about, which is that if the NBA were to acknowledge that it's been wrong on this birthday thing for a while, what happens to the NBA history that we know? We're like, I'm thinking of, we consider Ozzie Schechtman to be the first man to get a basket in the NBA. The NBA has this origin story with Jewish men at the center of it and a community that is proud of that history. How do we find a way to acknowledge what really happened, but also still acknowledge that history?
It doesn't seem to me that it has to be an either or thing. That I don't know if you just expand record books. I don't know how you do it. You just open the door. The BAA was an incredibly important seminal basketball league. That's true no matter what. And it led to the creation of the NBA, as did the NBL. So there's no disrespect in making that point and just saying, hey, on this moment in time, this is when this new league was born.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Maddie Sofia here, host of a new daily science podcast from NPR called Shortwave. This week, the first all-female spacewalk. We got to talk to both of those astronauts in space.
We have you loud and clear, NPR.
Listen for that and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. On Wednesday night, as the Washington Nationals were on their way to taking a 2-0 lead in the World Series, ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. tweeted, "Even if the Astros get swept, the players will still have outperformed the team's pathetic front office." And we're going to start by talking about that pathetic front office this week. I'm joined by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach and by Lindsay Gibbs, sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello. Thank you, as always. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I was ready to jump on the Astros bandwagon until Tuesday morning, which is when I first heard about the actions of Astros assistant general manager Brandon Taubman. After the Astros beat the Yankees in the ALCS on Monday night, Taubman approached a group of female reporters, one of whom was wearing a purple bracelet for domestic violence awareness, and he shouted, "Thank God we got Osuna. I'm so bleeping glad we got Osuna." Sports Illustrated was the first to report this, but many, many eyewitnesses have now confirmed the story. The Astros acquired reliever Roberto Osuna while Osuna was serving a 75-game suspension for domestic violence. And the team has handled this about as poorly as a front office could. First, they called Sports Illustrated fake news. Then they issued a few sorry, not sorry apologies. They finally apologized and fired Taubman on Thursday, but then the GM seemed irked about having to answer questions about the whole thing. And I'm sure this has been a terrible distraction for those Astros players who have never committed domestic violence. But I'm not really sure I care that it's a distraction. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think this whole thing has been so appalling. All week, I've just been picturing those three female reporters having that yelled at them and what that must have felt like. And I'm so angry that they had to report it themselves, that the Sports Illustrated writer was the one who had to report it herself, when we know that other male reporters actually saw this as well and have said since that they should have spoken up sooner. Let's share the burden here of calling out these people and of dealing with organizations that continue to perpetuate this mindset.
Will, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I actually find it strange that the story for some people seems to have shifted in the last couple of days to one of a failure of messaging. They have been really bad, certainly, in their response to this. But of course they were bad, because they're not sorry because they're jerks. I mean, they're not sorry, you know, and of course they give terrible responses because they have people like this that work for them in the first place. Yes. I have friends of mine that work in public relations. They're like, wow, we need to get somebody on that. And I'm like, no, you shouldn't work for people like that.
The Astros seem to be upset that we keep bringing up this domestic violence thing, right? That they even had to answer questions about why they brought on a guy who was on a 75-game suspension. And I want to be like, hey, you want to stop having to answer questions about domestic violence? Just take domestic violence seriously. And then you won't have to answer questions about it. And we can all talk about baseball again. I'd love that.
But they made a $300,000 donation. They kept touting that.
Oh, well, cool.
And I was like, how much money do you make?
Good point. All right, Will, you're up.
So there's this weird part of baseball culture, as we saw with George Springer when in Game 1 of the World Series. He thought he had hit a home run, so he did not run out of the box quickly enough, and there were some who thought, not me, that he should have scored later in the inning. This happened earlier in the NLDS with Ronald Acuna, who is the best player on the Braves. Like, Ronald Acuna hit, like, I don't have the stat cast on this, but he hit three balls to the moon. Literally to the moon. But all people can talk about is, like, well, that Acuna, he's not hustling out of the box. And now listen, batters should run out of the box. Sprint. Do it. Great. Just so these people won't yell at you so much. But it is so strange to me. I always call this the superstar fallacy, which is basically the idea that, like, when a team loses, they always look at the best player and blame him or her rather than blaming the worst players who are the reason that they lost because they're not good.
I'm a big Carolina Panthers fan, and there was a fumble in the Super Bowl that Cam Newton didn't jump on immediately enough, and that was all the sports media talked about for like a week. And this is a player who is regularly bashed for being too aggressive or putting himself in harm's way too often. People just want these superstars to constantly show that they have the work ethic and the grit and everything, in addition to all the talent, because if those of us sitting on our couches had that talent, we would always be hustling. And it's just not true.
It's not.
It is totally not true. Like, have you looked around? Like, people are not hustling.
I always think of Manny Ramirez in Boston, right? So we even came up with a phrase, like, that's just Manny being Manny. And look, it's totally true that Manny Ramirez rarely looked like he was trying very hard. The ball would come at him in the outfield, and he'd kind of just, like, lop over to it and pluck it out of the air like it was no big deal. But just because it looked effortless doesn't mean it actually was effortless. And I feel like it's part of, like, people are sitting at home saying, like, well, I could do better than that. When the fact is, no, you really can't do better than that. Right, Will?
Yeah, I think the Venn diagram of people who say they're not hustling enough. And you know what? Pete Rose got a raw deal. Lots of crossover. And it's funny, of course, the great joke about Pete Rose is his nickname, Charlie Hustle, was given to him by Whitey Ford to make fun of him because he walked and sprinted to first base like a chump. And now we've made a whole culture that that fetishizes it. It's very strange.
All right, Lindsay, take us away from baseball, please.
Well, there is another sports championship going on this weekend, and that is the National Women's Soccer League championship game. Of course, everyone was talking about women's soccer earlier this summer when the U.S. Women's National Team won the World Cup. But I think it's an exciting time to look at how women's soccer has grown. This is the seventh season of the league. And we've actually seen, whereas 4 years ago after the World Cup, we didn't see that much of a World Cup bump. The league really didn't take advantage of it. I think this season we really have. Sponsors such as Budweiser have really stepped up. You've had a lot of the teams drawing huge crowds, you know, setting attendance records. And ESPN is going to be showcasing the final.
The fact that it's been going for 7 years is such a good sign, because this was an early thing with the MLS, too. It was, initially, everyone was very worried, like, okay, well, we need the World Cup to give us a big boost, and maybe we'll be able to keep going. And you want those bumps, but what you really want is in 2 years, when there is no World Cup, for it to have been higher than it was 4 years ago. And so far, that's been what's happening. And that is an exciting thing to be able to see. I saw the Louisville got an expansion franchise. Yeah. That is very exciting. The idea that, like, expansion, like, early on, it's hard for any league to get some kind of footing, to not only get that footing, but to be expanding. It's very exciting.
I'm going to throw a bummer on this. It's not a total bummer. It's kind of like one of those fake bummers. But I can't help but feel, for the first time ever, that the U.S. is actually lagging behind other countries in bringing up women's soccer right now. England and Germany have sold out Wembley for their friendly in November. That's Wembley, 90,000 seats. Mm. In Spain, La Liga fans keep breaking their own attendance records. It went from 40,000 at a game to 60,000 at a game just in last season. And yes, attendance is up, but the league average is right around 7,000 people per game. Is this just that old Americans don't like soccer thing, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think you have to build fan bases, right? You have to get into communities, you have to build fan bases, and it takes time. The next big thing, though, that the NWSL has to work out is how to get these players more money. Mm-hmm. It's going to start losing its stars. So Sam Kerr, who's the Australian, this could be her last game in the NWSL because she only can make about like $42,000 in the NWSL. And there are these leagues and these teams over in Europe that are offering to pay her upwards of $1 million. You're right. Overseas, they are putting pressure on the United States to really prove that women's soccer is something that we care about. And I think that can only be good in the long run.
All right. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach and Lindsay Gibbs, sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Thanks to both of you.
An honor, as always.
Thanks.
Jack Wedge is a hotel worker from Prince Edward Island, Canada. A while back, he found himself attempting the unthinkable.
Tyson goes to work right away, and he gets Trevor in trouble, and he's down. He'll have to take the stand.
Jack was going to face Mike Tyson, the 5'11", 218-pound heavyweight boxing champion of the world. But as if that wasn't challenging enough, Jack would be wearing a blindfold. Okay, so we're actually talking about a video game, the 1987 classic Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And while this wasn't going to be quite as risky as stepping into the ring with a real-life Tyson, it was still going to be crazy. Some even thought impossible. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
Jack Wedge was maybe 4 years old when he first saw Mike Tyson's Punch-Out at a friend's house. Pretty soon, his dad brought home a copy.
It's one of the games I used to play a lot with my dad when I was young.
Punch-Out is a boxing game. You control a character named Little Mac. You can punch and dodge, and if you knock your opponent down for the 10 count, you win. But if Little Mac is knocked down 3 times before that, you lose. That's what makes the final boss, Mike Tyson, so difficult.
His punches send you to the mat in one hit for a good portion of the fight. One mistake and you're down. You're down 3 times, that's it. Fight's over, you lose.
When he was 17, Jack discovered the website GameFAQs. There, Jack found a community of gamers that shared different techniques and ways to play the game, like trying to win only on the 10 count or without using any star punches, Little Mac super move.
Before I know it, you know, I'm hooked, along with this other about half a dozen people or so.
Jack began speedrunning, a way of playing video games where people try to beat a game as quickly as possible. But around 2005, the niche community felt they had accomplished just about everything they possibly could.
Weekly or daily messages being sent back and forth there became like monthly to bi-monthly messages, and it was just kind of... things slowed down for that right around there. I mean, I'd still play the game the odd time because it was one of my favorites, but just very casual there.
Then in 2014, Jack was watching an internet stream of a charity event featuring elite speedrunners. That's when he saw a gamer named Sinister One trying to beat Punch-Out, blindfolded. Punch-Out relies on twitch reflex and memorizing patterns, and the patterns get more confusing and punches stronger with each of the 14 fights. But by listening to the game sound effects and memorizing enemy patterns, Sinister One was able to predict what was coming without even looking. Sinister One had attempted the blindfolded run at that charity event twice before, but he had never come close to reaching the last fight. So when he reached Tyson this time, onlookers wondered if he was about to make history.
Hey, I've got a quick question.
Sure.
Are you really human?
But Sinister One knew better when it came to Tyson.
So I'm just going to say something about Mike Tyson. I don't want to say it's impossible to beat him blindfolded, but the odds of it happening would probably be about the same as the odds of winning Powerball or something like that.
Sinister One explained that parts of Tyson's patterns are just random. You couldn't memorize them. And with his one-hit knockout punches in the early part of the fight, Tyson knocked out Sinister One in less than a minute. Mike Tyson looked unbeatable, but Jack wasn't convinced.
It was kind of like a, well, maybe, I don't know, I kind of want to try it myself.
A few months went by before Jack would get his chance. He had a job and a daughter, and this was going to take some time. Then in early 2015...
I remember just waking up one morning and looking out the window, and it was white. And then I remember, all right, okay, sure, you know, getting up, getting my breakfast into me, going to go outside for my morning smoke, and I open the door, and it's white, and falling towards me, and I can't see anything.
It was a record-setting snowstorm, and Jack was stuck inside for a week.
I was buying cigarettes from more prepared neighbors of mine by the end of that week there, and going maybe a little crazy with nothing to do but have a couple of beers to unwind a bit every day.
Jack knew that he finally had the chance to do what no other human being had ever done before. By this time, a member from the original Punch-Out GameFAQs, D. Tysonator, had beaten Mike Tyson blindfolded. But he had skipped to the final boss. No one had ever beaten the game blindfolded from start to finish. With the help of Sinister One, D. Tysonator, and other gamers, Jack soon mastered specific sequences of moves that allowed him to pull off perfectly timed punches and dodges for each opponent.
Within probably the span of 5 or 6 days of working on this, I was very consistently getting to the last fight, Mike Tyson. But I'd still be getting destroyed all the time there. It's like, all right, you know, back to the drawing board on this one.
Jack started filming his attempts. The first 13 rounds were usually a breeze, but Tyson always brought back the nerves.
Yeah! All right, I have some new tricks on Tyson, so I'm going to at least make it at around one here.
But even with his new tricks, Jack failed to beat Tyson during his first 3 filmed attempts. On his 4th try, he survived the most difficult part of the fight, and after being knocked down only once over the first 2 rounds, Jack felt good entering the third and final round.
I can do this. Oh, okay. I could have won in round two. All right. Focus, buddy. We got this. We got this.
But Tyson wasn't going down easy. He connected on a few early punches, and halfway through the round, as Jack hit Tyson with multiple jabs, Tyson threw an uppercut that knocked him down for the second time. Jack was one knockdown away from losing yet again. And with the clock ticking, Tyson connected on two more uppercuts. Another hit would finish Jack. But if he could stay on his feet until the final bell, Jack would win.
Yes!
It's a sense of pride, I guess, you know, even though it's just a video game or whatever, but at least for like this moment in time, you know, like you are the best in the world at this one thing.
Jack posted the video on YouTube. After the first couple days, it still had fewer than 100 views, but
the next day when I woke up, or rather when I was awoken by my phone just beeping constantly, it's like, pick up my phone, look at it. You have 249 YouTube notifications. I'm like, what?
The video had gone viral, and as surprised as he was to see the attention his video received, Jack was just as surprised to hear from people that he hadn't spoken to in years.
Man, I haven't seen you in ages. We should, like, hang out and have a drink or something, because that was so neat, and now you're famous and all that. It's like, you know, do they think that I'm, you know, getting money off this because it's got, like, so many views or something? Because I'm not.
4 years since the epic fight, Jack still plays an occasional game of Punch-Out. And his friends? Well, the small group of Punch-Out speedrunners has grown. Jack says the game got a boost in popularity after his video went viral. After all, he beat Mike Tyson, blindfolded.
That's Only a Game's Jonathan Chang. Elite ultramarathoner Dave Mackey was scheduled to have his leg amputated on November 1st, 2016.
So the night before the surgery, we had a leg amputation party on Halloween night at the local running store.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
How will you remember the past decade in music? I'm Robin Hilton with NPR's All Songs Considered. Join us as we look back at the defining trends and moments of the 2010s, from Beyoncé to Bandcamp. Listen twice a week on All Songs Considered from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, in honor of the Rugby World Cup final, we take a look at the surprisingly long history of the sport in host country Japan. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The NBA season has begun, and the biggest matchup of the first week was the newly redesigned LA Clippers versus the newly redesigned LA Lakers, aka Kawhi Leonard versus LeBron James. Is it just me, or is it super fun to have an actual basketball rivalry in LA?
Yeah, I just wish it didn't take place at, you know, in the Pacific time zone. You know, I mean, I'm an old guy. I can't stay up and watch games at 11 o'clock. No, it is good, and the long-suffering Clipper fans have deserved this for quite some time.
Well, Kawhi dropped 30 points in that game, despite the boos coming from the Staples Center stands. Apparently, Lakers fans hold a grudge, eh?
Yeah, a little bit. I think they do, yes. But, of course, the real battle is Kawhi and LeBron. That's the mainspring of what is now going to be, I think, a very entertaining rivalry. Although I think the Clippers are a much better team at this point.
Kawhi's former team, the Toronto Raptors, received their championship rings on Tuesday. And I know this is going to come as a shock to you, Charlie, but they're the largest ever in the NBA.
This arms race, more specifically a fingers race, has got to stop. I mean, it's a 1.25 carat diamond on top of an image of the Larry O'Brien trophy. The only thing this ring doesn't have is video. And I'm sure that's coming.
The ring is so big that 1.25 diamond looks tiny. The ring includes 650 diamonds, totaling about 14 carats. And the team actually gave a ring to superfan Drake, but he commissioned a Beverly Hills jeweler to make him a bigger one with 30 carats of diamonds. And why am I not surprised by this?
The bling race has got to stop very soon because, I mean, half the Toronto lineup is going to have carpal tunnel by the middle of the season.
The only opening night game fans in China were able to watch was that Lakers-Clippers game. Now China is saying that NBA Commissioner Adam Silver will face, quote, retribution for claiming that Chinese officials wanted Daryl Morey fired for sending a tweet in support of the protesters in Hong Kong. Does this controversy show any signs of dying down?
Well, I mean, there are long memories in China, and frankly, I don't care. I mean, I think what Daryl Morey did was the right thing, and I think there are probably more people in China who want to watch the NBA than want to punish it for whatever it is that their government has decided the NBA did to it. Not that public opinion matters very much over there at the moment.
This will come to some conclusion on which both sides will be satisfied once the real fervor dies down. But at the moment, I think the NBA has managed to crawl, struggle, and sort of blunder its way back to the high ground.
Michael Jordan is a very, very, very good basketball player, but I'm going to say maybe he's not such a great judge of basketball talent, because this is what he had to say about six-time All-Star, three-time champion, and two-time league MVP Steph Curry.
Yeah, he's still a great player. Not a Hall of Famer yet, though.
Oh, Michael, are you okay?
Yeah, that's a little bit silly. You know, of course he's a Hall of Famer by now. If I was Steph Curry, though, down the line a little bit, I would ask Michael Jordan to induct me into the Hall of Fame. I think that would be a great move.
The good news for Astros ace Justin Verlander was that he broke John Smoltz's career mark for strikeouts in the postseason during Wednesday's Game 2 of the World Series. The bad news was, well, pretty much everything else was bad news, right?
Yeah, pretty much. He had an epically bad start in the World Series. And now his numbers as a World Series pitcher are dreadful.
Well, Verlander now has the fourth highest World Series ERA among pitchers who've had five or more starts. And I suppose among sports fans for whom the only thing that matters is winning another championship, that means he's completely and utterly useless, right?
Oh, you'll hear that. Absolutely. You'll hear that Justin Verlander is somehow flawed because of his numbers in the World Series. But the other people on the list, namely Don Newcomb, Carl Erskine, and Don Sutton, of the list of the top five worst ERAs in World Series history with the minimum of five starts, that's a Hall of Fame talent right there. So you can't judge this guy by the fact that he's had a grotesque, terrible World Series.
And finally, Charlie, a Russian hockey team has been fined 30,000 rubles after their coach threatened to set fire to a referee's car. And that's how they do it in Russia, eh?
Yeah. He said he was joking around, and you could tell he was joking because he said car. If he was serious, he would have said he was going to set fire to the guy's apartment.
Oh, my bad. Keep going.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Right. That is not an alibi I expect to go over well with the Continental Hockey League.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
What's the best way to make sure you never miss a second of our show? Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. And while you're there, leave us a review. It helps other listeners find our show. On August 16th, 2014, Dave Mackey lined up for the final event of the Leadman Challenge. Dave had already completed a marathon, a 50-mile run, a 100-mile bike ride, and a 10K run. But this, the final event, would be the most challenging, a 100-mile trail run. 19 hours, 10 minutes, and 45 seconds later, Dave finished. For completing the race in under 24 hours, Dave earned a highly coveted Leadville 100 belt buckle. The finish placed Dave second overall in the 2014 Leadville Race Series. The only person who finished the five events faster, his good friend Bob Africa. But Dave would soon face a far more serious challenge. Reporter Cherie Turner has the story.
On May 23, 2015, Dave Mackey was out doing what he'd done for years, training on the trails near his Boulder, Colorado home. But in a matter of seconds on that beautiful spring day, everything changed.
I stepped on a large loose rock, which was about 300 pounds, but it levered out of the soil and proceeded to send me basically out into outer space And I just basically started to tumble off the backside of the peak. I tried to control my fall. I was able to kind of spin around and grab the side of the mountain. And I was grabbing branches, grabbing rocks, grabbing dirt, trying to control my fall and free falling for probably about 10 feet and landed on my back on a space about the size of a child's mattress. But I landed on my back there, and it wasn't like landing on a mattress. It was like landing on hard dirt and rock. And I remember just leaning forward and looking at my legs, and there was the rock, and it came down and tumbled onto my left lower leg.
One of Dave's friends happened to be running nearby. He heard Dave's screams and within about a minute was there to help. He managed to lever the rock off, but what that revealed was disturbing.
I had this open tibial fracture. You know, the skin was torn open. There was, you know, I could see the bone pieces, and right away I knew I had a big problem.
The rescue was treacherous. It took hours to evacuate Dave and get him to the hospital, where he went into surgery to fix his lower left leg. What no one knew at the time was how much bacteria had gotten into the wound at the site of the accident.
The bone pieces actually ended up dying. They had to pull those out, so I was left with basically a dysfunctional leg. It doesn't have a bone in there, no tibia, then you can't walk. I proceeded to have 13 surgeries over the next year and a half. There's bone grafting, muscle grafting, skin grafting.
Dave needed a cane to walk. He was in chronic pain. A return to ultras appeared impossible, unless he chose to amputate.
When I finally decided that, it was actually somewhat of a sigh of relief. It was a feeling of, you know, weight lifted off my shoulders because, you know, I knew the infection would be gone. I knew the all those problems and surgeries and indefinite outcomes would be basically gone, you know, with one surgery. I had the surgery on November 1st, 2016, which, as you can tell, is the day after October 31st, which is Halloween. So the night before the surgery, I invited all my friends to a leg amputation party on Halloween night at the local running store. And we had a big party. And the next day, I lost my leg. I remember going under anesthesia, and as the nurse literally put the gas over the mouth to take some deep breaths, I remember tears rolling down my face. And I woke up, you know, within a couple hours, and I remember looking down, and you have one whole leg, and the other leg is under the covers, and there's a stump under there. And I knew that my life would never be the same again.
Before Dave even left the hospital, before he'd learned to walk or hike or run, he set his sights on returning to the Lead Man, that five-event series that finishes with a 100-mile trail race.
I saw that series as the pinnacle, more or less, of possible recovery. If I could do that with one leg, I could pretty much do anything.
And if it seems a bit, well, crazy that Dave would focus on completing such a huge feat over relentless mountain terrain on one leg, even before he'd learned how to take a single step, Dave wasn't the only one who thought it was possible. Dave's friend, Bob Africa, visited the hospital the day after the surgery and gave Dave the belt buckle he'd earned in the 2014 Lead Man when he and Dave had finished first and second.
And he said, "You can do this."
Over the next 6 months, Dave set to the arduous, often painful task of refining the fit of his prosthetic and learning how to walk and then run with it.
I was probably a little too ambitious. I first went for that run, and I went out too hard. I completely abraded and chafed my leg up, but it was, you know, I wasn't sidelined. I was just limping around the next day, but that was a good thing. It's part of the process. Take a step back, but you're taking two steps forward, and that's basically how it was for a year.
14 months post-surgery, Dave lined up for a 50K race. That's about 31 miles. It was his first ultra since the accident.
It was an awesome, cathartic experience to cross that finish line. I wasn't in tears crying in the dirt, but it was a deeper, more spiritual experience than I'd probably outwardly showed. It felt really darn good to do it. The fall should have killed me. Never mind the rock, never mind it landing on my leg. I fell 60 feet, and on any other day of the week, that would have killed me. I would have landed on my head. I would have broken my neck, and I didn't. And I feel like when I'm doing these things that I did before that I love, I feel like I appreciate those things even more.
As good as that may have felt, it was only preparation for Dave's ultimate goal, that Lead Man series, which would start 5 months later. But going into the first Lead Man event, the marathon, Dave says he was scared.
Running on a prosthetic running blade, which is basically a boomerang-shaped piece of carbon fiber that just basically sticks onto the socket, and running around the mountains in Colorado with those things, it's a super technical course. There's cobblestones all over the place. There are things to fall on and get potentially injured. I thought that I might just, you know, fail right here at step one of the Lead Man series. And everything just kind of came together really well, though. I had a great run, and I was ecstatic after the trail run.
Next in the series, Lead Man athletes choose to complete either a 50-mile mountain bike race on Saturday or a 50-mile trail run on Sunday. Dave did the bike race, but then...
pretty much on a whim, the next day I decided to do the 50-mile run. I wanted to see what I could do, and I felt like crap. I felt terrible after that. You know, two 50-mile events back-to-back on a prosthetic. Not in my wildest dreams, I think I would be able to complete that. But I did it.
A month later, Dave tackled the 100-mile mountain bike race and the 10K run with confidence. But it all came down to the final and most brutal event, the 100-mile trail run. During the first half of the race, Dave says his upper thighs were exhausted. When he reached his support crew at the 50-mile mark, things were not looking good.
I felt like trash. I was going at a slow walk. I was shuffling. And I just sat down in the chair. I plopped down, and I looked around, and I was like, I don't think I can get out of this chair. And after 10 minutes of sitting there, I knew just getting up and walking one step at a time, maybe things would turn around.
Dave left the aid station at a walking pace. Just over 5 miles ahead was Hope Pass, the highest point in the race at over 12,000 feet.
I got my energy back and started to feel really good, which is a surprise. But in these races, you surprise yourself. You go through literally the depths of hell, and then you find yourself on a mountain summit, and you feel like you're on top of the world, and you feel great. And then you have another depths of hell experience later in the race, but then you get through. I got to that top of Hope Pass, and I knew at that moment it was like the parting of the Red Sea. It was like, my path is clear. I'm gonna do this.
Dave finished the Leadville 100-mile trail race in 24 hours, 54 minutes. With that, he earned himself another belt buckle, and he became the only one-legged athlete to complete the Lead Man.
For me, it was completing, you know, the return to who I was as a person who had lost his leg, the person who was trying to, you know, be, you know, as much of a whole human as he was before, even though he was missing his lower limb. You know, my kids ran to the finish line with me, and Ellen was there, my wife, and it was a life-changing experience I'll never forget.
That story came from reporter Cherie Turner. Dave Mackey completed the Lead Man again this year. What's next? Dave says he's considering a 200-mile run. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.